Please listen carefully.
And now, live from the Arboretum in McKinney, Texas, it's the Assuming Positions Podcast, with two hosts who are frantically trying to figure out the logistics of a unicycle built for two, Kevin and Mikey.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the Assuming Positions Podcast. Kevin over here.
And Mikey over here.
And much like we promised last week, we set an assignment for Mikey and for all of you, and hopefully you followed the assignment and went over to Disney Plus or your DVD collection or wherever your streaming things are sold and watched the 1991?
Yes, 91. Yes.
Film The Rocketeer.
The Rocketeer! You gotta say it way more exciting than that.
We like to do these, we call them reassumptions.
Yep.
We like to pull up older films that we may have enjoyed as kids or hadn't seen in a very long time that we remember were awesome and watch it again and see if it, quote unquote, holds up. Because that holds up argument is always a fun argument. Because sometimes some people think stuff does hold up, while another person will think it didn't hold up.
Yeah, I'm
fun talking points.
Exactly. And like nostalgia goggles are a thing. Like you can love something as a child and then never go back to it and just stays in your mind like, oh, this is awesome. But then you go back to visit, you're like, oh, I didn't see these flaws when I was 8 years old or 9 years old or whatever. So
I know so much stuff has been ruined for me.
Because you've been going back through stuff with your boys, right? You've been watching stuff with your boys lately?
Oh, well, not lately, but their whole life, when they became age appropriate for various things.
I got you.
And the problem is, too, with them, just like with anything else, everything evolves over time.
Yep.
So stuff that's made for them is just inherently going to be better than the stuff that was made for me as a kid, just because evolution of entertainment and the way things are done, and there's groundbreaking shows which affect all the rest of the shows and yada yada yada. So when you know you pull up The Adventures of He-Man or whatever it was called and show it to these modern kids, they're like, what is this stuff you're trying to feed me? This is terrible. And then you're sitting there going, this is pretty terrible. Why does Skeletor talk like that?
Are you trying to get me to buy action figures? What's going on? I get it.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. So anyway, after the He-Man debacle, I said, I'm not going to watch any G.I. Joe. I'm going to let that stay in my mind as perfect and terrific. And the only G.I. Joe I will watch are those funny old memes, proto memes from back in the day.
The PSAs. Yeah. The after school specials. I'm right there with you. Those are the best.
So that was a fun digression, but we're here talking about The Rocketeer. I watched it with my kids. They enjoyed it, and Mikey said, oh, I used to love that, but right? And you hadn't seen it. When's the last time you think you saw it?
I think I owned the VHS growing up. Like, I had the Disney clamshell of this one in my collection with Aladdin and Lion King, but I really don't think I've seen it since I was 13, 14, early teenage.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been a while. I won't say how many years that is for people doing the math, but it's been a minute.
It's been a while, yeah. I cannot say when the last time I had seen it, but in watching it, I realized that I must have seen it a lot or multiple times because it had that familiarity of a movie you've seen a lot.
And you kind of knew the beats that were coming and all that?
Exactly, because, you know, sometimes you'll watch a movie that you hadn't seen in a while that you'd only seen once, but you remembered enjoying it and it was good, and hey, this is on TV or whatever, I'm going to watch it again.
Yep.
And then some parts of it you're like, oh, I don't remember this part, you know? That didn't happen with this one, so I had obviously seen it multiple times.
I'm with you, yep.
But for me, it has probably been 20 years at least.
I was pleasantly surprised going back to this movie. I won't ruin our pizza rating spoiler for the end, but I will say that up top, my hot take is that I enjoy this more as an adult than I think I ever did as a kid. But
oh, wow.
Let's get into it.
Let's get into it. So The Rocketeer, it's always been a Disney movie, right?
Yes, always Disney.
Buena Vista Pictures, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And directed by Joe Johnston, who was kind of newer then, I think, a newer director.
Yeah, this is early in his career. Yep.
But now he's one of the Hollywood kind of tentpole directors, I guess you call them.
Yeah, and he's a director of one of your favorites. I believe the reason you may know that name is because of the Captain America franchise.
Yeah, he did the first Avenger.
Which, for my two cents, is the strongest Captain America movie, but I don't know if that's a hot take or not. But
and it's funny, too, because knowing that and then rewatching this movie, it's like the feel is so similar.
Yes.
And, I mean, it's set in almost the exact same era.
Yep.
And as such, I mean, it's almost like, is this part of that Kevin Feige brilliance where he's like, okay, we need to do this kind of retro-y movie? Because they always try and make the wonderful thing about Marvel movies, and the reason why I think they do better than a lot of the DC movies, is that they try to make the movie feel like the character.
Oh, I got you. So, yeah, yeah.
And we've said that before on the podcast. So he's like, okay, this movie is like a 40s movie, but we can't make it like a 40s movie, but what can we make it like? And it seems like Kevin Feige brilliance to be like Rocketeer, Joe Johnston.
Yep.
You know what I mean? It's Disney. We're all in the same family.
Oh, no, I'm with you. And the fact that they're setting it, I don't know if it's the Wonder Years principle or the Kevin Feige thing where it's sort of, let's go back in time, let's make it in a certain period so we know the look and style of everything and we can sort of control it and keep a consistent vibe to it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is actually based on a comic book, so this is a comic book movie.
Yes.
And it is, I was calling it last week, it's kind of a proto-Marvel superhero movie, really.
Especially because it's a one and done. We never got anything after this, but it is the typical superhero origin story that we've seen countless times already.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because I'm going to pull this out of my back pocket from now on. But when people talk about how, oh, there was no good superhero movies before Marvel Cinematic Universe movies,
yep,
which I always agreed with, but I think people were kind of just talking about, well, first of all, the X-Men movies were good, so that's untrue. And the Spider-Man movies were good, so that's also untrue. But I think they're more talking about before the 2000s when they make that statement.
Exactly. And they're talking about superheroes that are like instantly recognizable, like Batman, Superman, X-Men. Those are names, even if you don't read comics, you know about them. Rocketeer, it was a comic book, but I don't think if you said that name, people would be like, oh, Rocketeer, unless they've seen this movie or read the comic book by Dave Stevens, all that stuff,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I agree. It is kind of an off character.
Yes.
As it were. And I don't know why they didn't make any more of them. In your research, did you come across that at all?
It's the usual Hollywood story is that it was just, there was production delays and budget arguments, and it had a budget and performed well, but didn't perform well enough. So they sort of just cast it aside.
Wow. Because it deserved more, in my opinion. I could see more.
Oh, I would like to live in this world for at least three more movies. I'm with you.
Okay, so who's in it? Now, this is funny, too, because when I kind of said, I was like, did I just like this movie because Jennifer Connelly was in it? Because, come on. She was in so much good stuff, though, anyway.
Exactly.
Makes good choices. I don't know if it's her or her agent or Por Qué No Los Dos, but she's been in so much good stuff. And eventually an Academy Award winner, right?
Oh, Academy Award winner indeed, but she's perfectly fit here because she's the ultimate pinup girl for this movie that takes place in 1930, 100%.
Yep. So she's plays Jenny Blake, who is the love interest slash femme. She's not the femme fatale because that's be the bad guy.
It would be the evil lady, yes.
Yeah, I would call her that. She's probably the heroine, we'd call it, because she does get hers as we go through it.
Yeah.
She's not just damsel in distress in this one at all.
Nope.
Once again, we can point back to, hey, this was 1991, and you know what I mean? So, well, anyway.
It's not how they were doing stuff. Yeah, no, I'm with you.
But Cliff Secord, who is the Rocketeer, is played by Billy Campbell, which is interesting because I was like, who the heck is Billy Campbell?
Who's Billy Campbell?
I mean, he's really good in this movie.
Yep.
And apparently he's done lots of other things. He's a real working actor, but it seemed like he kind of went more the working actor, television character actor route.
Yeah, yeah.
Even despite his really good matinee idol looks.
Yeah, because once we were rewatching this movie, I did the deep dive, and I know that, like, I recognize the face. He's one of those faces you see, like, oh, I know that guy. But then you go do a deep search on him, and you were like, oh, he did Dynasty on TV, and then he did this? Like, what is that?
And again, I'm not disparaging him in any way, shape, or form. I'm just saying that a lot of times when you have those matinee idol good looks, you just keep doing this type of stuff.
Yes.
Like the Rocketeer. But he's gone on to become a very successful character actor, which I think actually most actors prefer. From our interviews we've done with real actors and from interviews I've heard other people with actors.
Yeah, you get to bear yourself in a role and take on an identity. I'm with you.
And speaking of character actors, Alan Arkin as PvP Body is I know. He's real good in this, Alan Arkin.
I'll spoiler this up front. There are two main actors I think are key to this movie. One is Peavy by Alan Arkin, and the second is the chewing gum that shows up about four times in this movie. But
chewing gum.
But Alan Arkin is Peavy. I think this is a Joseph Campbell, like, hero's journey type thing, but they're always, there always seems to be, like, the mentor, muse, like, wise guy, old prophet dude. And Alan Arkin is, as PV, is that dude 100%. Like, he's the voice of reason. He's the voice of, we can get this done, but here's how we need to do it. But also, don't be a dumb schmuck kid, you know? Go after the girl. Like, oh, Alan Arkin just delivers in this movie.
For sure. And then, to just top off the top four on the call sheet, is our villain. And was this guy your favorite Bond?
Timothy Dalton was no, that was Pierce Brosnan. It was close.
Oh, okay.
A similar vibe, but I did pick Pierce Brosnan because that's the Bond I grew up with. But Timothy Dalton is in that same class for sure.
So Timothy Dalton plays Neville Sinclair, the, well, spoiler alert, but come on.
Almost a 30-year-old movie at this point. I think we can negate all the spoiler alert.
Right. Timothy Dalton plays Neville Sinclair, who is kind of based on Errol Flynn. Ooh. And the conspiracy theory/rumor that Errol Flynn was a fascist spy.
This movie caused me to learn that because I was watching the movie, and Timothy Dalton, he is an old Bond, but I will say right now, I think he's perfect for the suave and charming yet evil, like, bad guy. Mm-hmm. Like, he's much more perfect as a bad guy. But there are scenes in this movie where they're cribbing from the screenplay of the old Errol Flynn Robin Hood movies where he's on set and he's acting like Robin Hood. And so I was doing that YouTube or the IMD rabbit hole where you go down, it's like, what is Timothy Dalton basing this off of? And it is Errol Flynn, and that rumor is true. Like, that's all over the internet. That blew my mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's great when you start doing a little research and you find out all this fun stuff. Another thing I found out when I was looking is that the inventor of the Rocketeer's jetpack.
Okay.
And hold on, we'll get into it, everybody. Let's the inventor of the Rocketeer's jetpack, this is kind of backstory stuff we're doing. In the comic book, that character is not Howard Hughes. That character is a named character that they did not have the rights to in this movie.
Oh, you're talking That's about it. Doc Savage. Okay.
Yeah. They couldn't use it for the movie. So they were like, okay, who invented it? And they, for some reason, they go to the Elon Musk of the 1930s. Howard Hughes, was in the Aviator, was kind of his sort of, I don't know if it was a biopic really, or was
I think it was the Hollywood dramatization, but close enough, you know, for government work.
So it's funny because he's portrayed as the early kind of genius Howard Hughes, and not the, if you've ever seen Aviator.
Yeah. Not the crazy hermit, like, peeing in bottles kind of Howard Hughes.
So, anyway.
Here's what happened on my rewatch, though, is that Howard Hughes is played by an actor named Terry O'Quinn.
Yes.
Who some people may recognize that name, but for me, I didn't recognize it until I went back to it this time. I saw him and I was like, that's Locke from Lost. I love the show Lost, and he was one of my favorite characters, and to see him as, like, an up-and-comer sort of new actor in Hollywood was just was like, oh, he's perfect for Howard Hughes. Oh, he fits it.
Yeah, he did a great job.
But it's Howard Hughes to the extreme. I mean, we get the eccentric. He's the one that's responsible for building the rocket that makes our Rocketeer.
Yeah, so let's go ahead, and we're going to spoil this whole thing and go through the plot points because I think this movie kind of deserves a lot of it.
Yes.
So, like we said, this is based off a comic book. The funny thing was is when I was watching it with my kids, I did have to remind them a couple times that it's a comic book. because there are a lot of things that happen, action-y things that just, there's plot armor.
Yep.
There's oh, really? That was lucky type stuff. But
stuff it's that a comic. Fits the narrative. It's like, oh, we got to get to this next yes. plot point. Here we go.
But it's a comic book. And the funny thing is it made me realize that you can do that in a very masterful way where you totally just are willing to suspend your disbelief and you just grab that popcorn and start throwing it in your mouth.
Yep.
And then you can also do it in a terrible, clunky way where you just like raise up your hands and want to walk out of the theater.
Yeah, you have some character explain some plot point and just be like, this is how it is, but that's not how Rocketeer operates. I'm with you.
No, I'd say the Rocketeer is definitely the latter. Yes. Okay, that's fine. You just keep, there's a lot of, okay, that's fine. Yep, okay, that's fine. I buy it.
Makes sense in this world, yep. I'm along for the ride.
So we're set in 1938 Los Angeles, and you're learning about this guy, Cliff Secord, this pilot, and PV. They're building a plane to, they're basically racers. They're airplane racers.
Yes.
And they have this cool mono wing, very modern for 1938 plane.
The
BG, and it's great looking. You know, he's going to take it for the test flight. They put all their money into it. They mm-hmm. this I just love how these movies, they like lay out everything for you. This will all come to pass later, so we're telling you about this now.
Yes.
And if you're paying attention, you'll never be lost.
Nope. They're setting up that Cliff is a grade A airman, whether he's in a plane or strapped to a rocket. He's got his lucky gum, PV's his guide man, and they'll do right in all circumstances where things go wrong.
Yeah, you know, this movie is, I know it's Joe Johnston and everything, but it has a very Spielberg-y feel in the way it does stuff like that.
Absolutely.
Like you said, the gum, they really play off his gum, because they're like, he's chewing gum, and he always takes his chewing gum and sticks it onto everything he flies.
Yes.
And of course, PV gets mad at him because he just put a nice paint job on this brand new plane. And he's like, what, do you want me to crash? So that's like his superstition is sticking the gum on
yep.
the outside of his planes. And they make you want to know that because it comes into play later.
It's a classic Disney foreshadowing. It's just the innocent moment that happens in the first act that, oh, guess what? It's a surprise twist in the third act.
Yeah. And then he sticks his picture of his girl up on the plane. And that's Jenny Blake. And you're like, oh, yeah, hey, look at that. He's got his plane. He's got his dashing pilot.
Yep.
Like, this is great. then it's great because then suddenly we cut to, it turns into a gangster movie, right?
Oh, it's Bonnie and Clyde, like right off the bat.
So we got the feds. And man, they've got the feds chasing the gangsters. The gangsters have stolen something. We don't know what it is. And the feds are after them. And it's the classic 1930s shoot first, ask questions later type Grand Theft Auto police force. You know, they're just running and gunning.
Exactly. And it's the old Hollywood. It's early 90s. Like, computer graphics aren't really a big proponent right now. So it's all real. It's real car chases. It's real yep. like stunt bullets, and they're driving yep. and planes, stunt plane flying. Oh, it's wonderful. Yep.
There was a bunch of times during this movie where I was like, this is 91. They're probably really doing a lot of this stuff. You yep. guys realize, you know, they're really doing that.
Yes.
Yeah. So, cause even the Rocketeer stuff, when he's flying around, that's just classical matte, whatever that stuff was called. I don't know what the technical term.
Yeah. The matte masking or the.
Yeah.
The,
yeah.
But with that, for all the Rocketeer flying around on the quote unquote green screen, it's the old school movie craft of, for all this new technology of they have showing this guy flying around, they're incorporating it with all these practical effects to make it blend in. Oh, it's mm-hmm. wonderful. So,
and it's interesting because it's back then they had to do it that way because that was the only way to do it. It kind of allows it to hold up because we've gone back to that now because they've realized that that way looks better.
Yes.
So it's kind of interesting how you'll go and watch like a Spider-Man movie from 10 years later.
Oh, yeah.
And you'll be like, oh, this looks kind of wonky.
Because it's all CGI. Yep.
Yeah. That's real interesting. So that has that benefit there.
But you were talking mobster movie. This definitely stuff that's one of the elements they throw right in front of you. It's the feds versus the mobsters in fedoras and three piece suits.
Yeah. And I love it because they don't even say like, let's not make them talk like a freaking film noir film. No, they're like, let's make them talk like it's a film noir film.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of like the feds are on me. See.
Oh yeah. Right in the kisser. I did make a note. Here's the line I have in my notes, which shows that they picked out the specific period dialogue that I love. But he says, oh, yeah, your partner's getting fitted for a pine overcoat. I'm like, that's totally 1930s.
I love it. I know. This greatness. So anyway, but my favorite thing is that this run and gun chase is going on while Cliff is testing the race plane, and he sees these two cars racing across a field. And it's real interesting because this is like one of those, that makes sense, that he's like, what the heck are those cars doing running across that field over there? So he flies over there to see.
Yep.
And of course, the mobsters are like, the feds got a plane.
We
got
to take it down. Shoot everything in sight.
Yeah. He gets Tommy gunned.
That's the only weapon that exists in this movie, I think. I don't think there were a couple of pistols, but the only like automatic weapon I saw throughout this entire movie was the Tommy gun. It's like,
well, until the end, there's some MP40s at the end.
Okay.
Well, but those would be MP30, whatever's those ones, the ones before the 40s. So,
but this entire movie was filled with guys that would say the line, I like you, but my Tommy gun don't.
Yeah. Time to do some stitching, boys.
Exactly. We're going to solve this problem with a whole bunch of bullets.
Oh, my goodness. It's just great how everything just leads right to the airfield. You got Cliff going down in his plane.
Yep.
You got the feds and the mobsters run right into the airfield.
You got the undercover guy running away with the experimental project that is the rocket pack we learn later, but it's for authorized use only. So it's this secret Steven Spielberg, like Ark of the Covenant you don't know about, that's in the back seat.
And he does a switcheroo with the vacuum cleaner.
As they do in the 1930s, the old switcheroony.
He does the switcheroo with the vacuum cleaner, and then he goes bang, wang, right into the fuel truck.
But that's the entire first act. The entire first act is just an action set piece, and it's done so expertly that you're 30 minutes in the movie before you realize, oh, I'm hooked. Like, this is fun. I've been having fun this whole time, and I've only learned about maybe 4 or 5 characters, you know? Ugh.
Right. It starts off just full throttle.
Yes.
So you're shoving popcorn in your mouth, and explosions are happening, and it's great.
But then once we get to, after all the action and the explosions, we actually get to learn about the character of the Rocketeer. We get to learn about Billy Campbell is more than just a stunt pilot. He's more than just Cliff Secord. He is a hero. He is our new Captain America, I guess, if you're Joe Johnston. I guess that's kind of how he had what he had in mind. But Cliff Secord is do right at all cost, make it right. Even if the feds are after you, you got to kind of do what you want. But they find him and Peavy find this rocket, and they were like, let's try it out.
Yeah, they're like, what the heck is this thing? And they accidentally set it off, and they're like, what the heck is this thing? And it's one of those things where they're trying to get it. This is another one of those plot things. They're trying to get it on his back real quick.
Yep.
But it makes perfect sense that it has a harness and stuff. It's not hard to figure out. You're supposed to wear it on your back.
Exactly.
And then the wonderful thing they do with Peavy is that Peavy is this, obviously, he's one of those mechanical geniuses who just learned it all on the streets. You know, he never went to the right schools or anything like that. But the dude is a legit genius.
Yeah.
Because right away he's looking at it going like, oh, this has a flinger valve, or I don't know what that he's in.
Yeah, the fuel injector is with the flux capacitor is attached to the blah, 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 the triangulate, the hypotenuse, all that stuff. He is definitely the idiot savant minus the idiot. He just, like, if it's mechanical or engineered, he knows how to fix it or reverse engineer it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I love it.
That's also, like I said, if you're paying attention, you get everything. And man, it's so skillful the way they can explain. And I'm using my kids for a lot of this, too, because this was their first time seeing it. Ooh. Now, I know what's going on, but it was kind of, you'd think it was a kind of throwaway line, but they do a good job explaining that biplane in there is from their, like, they had like some kind of clown stunt act they did.
Yep.
So this junky old biplane where the rocket was hidden in the sea. So to me, that was neat how they just established that, oh, that's what this plane is doing here.
And it's part of we're talking about superhero movies and sort of this is the origin story. But for as fast as everything's moving, like this movie is 148 minutes and it moves at a solid clip. Everything mm-hmm. happens one after the other. But mm-hmm. in this first act where you're learning that Cliff is a stunt pilot, he's got a clown show, there's a missing rocket ship, the feds are after him. Also, PV has to make money to fix planes. Like, this is world building and done expertly because it's done in a few couple lines every so often, but you're keeping up with all of it. It's all intrigue. It's wonderful. And then the fact that, okay, I guess we got to go ahead with this clown show, and the clown show leads to the next sort of catalyst in the story is just expert craftsmanship to me.
Yeah, because it's right after they find it, they take you right to the bad guy. I mean, you get to see the wonderful Paul Sorvino
yes.
all of a sudden as the head of the mobster talking to Neville Sinclair.
Yep.
And you find out Neville Sinclair's like, where's my rocket pack? Or, you know, where's my thing? My package. I think they're calling it the package at first. But
yes,
it's fun because he's training for his scene where he's doing the fencing.
To be number three actor in Hollywood, Errol Flynn style. I'm the best. I'm the method actor. I have to get into my role kind of thing.
Yeah. And again, like I said, Paul Sorvino, just legendary Hollywood character actor.
Oh, yeah. If you visualize the face of a mobster, you're probably picturing Paul Sorvino's face.
Yeah, pre-Sopranos era.
Yes.
For sure.
And probably his daughter, Mira Sorvino, although maybe she was around. But
I think she might have been a kid.
Hollywood kid legacy, man.
But yeah. So that scene's great. You get to see the suave, menacing, this where Timothy Dalton is. Both of them. You got Timothy Dalton and Paul Sorvino. That scene is great. Just the way it's played, the way they're playing off each other.
Yep.
The two other goons that are all in there like, see? You know, it's just, I don't know. I love every minute of that scene.
I'm with you. And we kind of mentioned the 007 Bond connection earlier, but to repeat it, Timothy Dalton works much better here as like the charming yet crazy megalomaniac bad guy than he ever did for me as Bond. Like, I believe him instantly when he's slashing lilies with his fencing rapier, and he's getting all mad and smashing champagne glasses, all that stuff.
And then what's funny to me too is like you go back to Cliff and PB, and they found this rocket. What do we do with this rocket pack? And Cliff's like, I don't know, but I got a date.
I know you're stressed with me, PB, but I got a real hot dime piece. She's waiting on the corner of the Five and Dime. I got to get her a Coney Island and a Long Island iced tea. You know what I'm saying? So.
Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah,
man.
Jenny Blake, Jennifer Connelly is the catalyst for a lot of the events in this movie numerous times, but that is the first instance of it, and that's when we get to find out. Jenny Blake is a woman of sophistication, and she's trying to be an actress, and that's the conflict other than feds versus Rocketeer is also Cliff versus his girlfriend's acting career.
Yeah, her aspirations, and she's living in this this kind of like house for ladies, or that sounds weird. But you know what I don't know what to call it.
It's of the time. It is a house for ladies. They have a community phone. They have a mistress or a madam that's like sort of their keeper and their warden.
But you know what's interesting is that, and this is a PG-13 podcast, so I'm going here. but no, seriously, suddenly you can see how like back in the day, like a brothel could go undercover.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because there are legitimate places that legitimately have a madam of the house
yep.
with a whole bunch of young ladies living there. It's a legitimate thing. And the little things in this movie are great. Just the little details, like when Cliff goes to pick Jenny up and the madam lady is there.
Yes.
And she pulls the, like, have her home by 11. You know my curfews. It's just, I don't know, it's just great.
And shortly after that, they're arguing about going to the movies. And Jenny Blake, Jennifer Connelly, is arguing to go to the Neville Sinclair movie, which is obviously our bad guy and our main actor. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. they also bring up the latest Cagney picture, which is what Cliff is all on board for. You know, mm-hmm. that's just of the time. It's perfect. He's like, oh, I want to go see the latest shoot 'em up. And she's like, I want to go see the latest theater movie, you know? Like,
yeah, and he's like, ugh. And then she's like, but it's about pilots. It's like a World War I movie or something, right?
And that's how they get there.
It's great. And also, too, they have the whole fun the guy who's the pilot watching a movie about pilots, finding all the things wrong with the movie about pilots.
Yep.
Type vibe.
Absolutely. Here's your Easter egg that I will pull up from my notes. The pilot they show as the test pilot in that movie screening is actually Dave Stevens, who is the creator of the graphic novel. That's where his
Wow.
Yeah, so that's where his cameo is. He got to be Alfred Hitchcock kind of style in the movie, but they put him in sort of the B-roll.
Yeah, it's funny because it starts off when they go to the theaters, they're showing a newsreel talking about the Nazis in Germany.
Oh, it's old school Hollywood movie pictures.
And this
yeah.
is yeah, with the newsreel, and this is pre World War II starting. But it's it's funny because the newsreel is just they might have actually found a real newsreel from back then for all we know, but because the newsreel has Hitler in it, if you go to the IMDb, he's listed in the cast list as himself.
Hey, thumbs up to these picture people for keeping it all authentic, but it is kind of hilarious that Hitler listed as himself is in the cast credits for this movie.
But it makes me wonder, I'm going to have to go back and check that can't be in the credits of the movie. Someone on IMDb's like goofing around putting that in there, right? I seriously doubt it's in the cast list of the movie.
I'm with you, but also the argument against that is that there are a lot of historically accurate details that they threw into this movie just as little tidbits to like tie in the narrative that it really isn't all that out of place. Because they were showing that, like, I mean, they were showing the newsreel before the movies, which is what they did in the movies in 1930. So I would believe that that's an actual news clip. So for accreditation purposes, that would have to be in there for sure.
Yeah, that's okay. It's crazy. Because when I saw it there, when I was looking at who was in it, and I saw it there, I'm like, what? Then I remembered the newsreel, and I was like, oh, okay.
And weird. It's kind of foreshadowing for the weird, not weird, but the twist that happens in the third act, where it's like, oh, guess what? The bad guys are these guys, which is kind of what you come to expect from all 1990s movies. But
so yeah, then we get back to PV and Cliff are testing out this rocket pack because they know that it needs to go back to the police, probably.
Yep.
But PV's too dang curious about it and wants to know about it.
Yep.
And before he gives it back. And Cliff wants to fly it around before he gives it back. But, you know, they test it first on, I guess, a Lindbergh. I think that was supposed to be Lindbergh. Statue?
They steal a statue, kind of like the old mascot, like prank, kind of 80s comedy style. They cut down the mascot statue, and they attach the rocket to it, and they fly it around. Oh, wonderful. And that's how they learn that they're going to need a helmet, which leads to the second icon of Rocketeer is, okay, I guess we have to develop a helmet for the Rocketeer.
Yep, which he makes out of a radio, which is great.
I didn't realize that on my first watching, but that is one of the things I picked up going back as an adult. You're realizing like what set pieces are they using to sort of build stuff, and you're like, oh, that's an old-timey radio.
That's an Art Deco-looking radio. Awesome.
I'm going to put my hot take 2 cents out here right now. I think the Rocketeer helmet is probably my favorite and most iconic out of all Hollywood helmets. Sorry, Boba Fett. I'm going to go with Rocketeer.
It is a really cool-looking helmet, for sure. His whole outfit is super cool.
Oh, yeah.
I love it.
And then they even address it in the movie, which I love. It's sort of meta fourth wall-breaking, but the first time he ever gets suited up, Cliff turns to Peeve, and he's like, how do I look? And he's like, you look like a hood ornament. And they get their test flight done. They get the helmet developed. And that's when we first start to get to see, starting about the second act of this movie, we get to see the fully formed Rocketeer finally flying around. And as a kid, this watching it now, I was immediately flashed back to my 13-year-old self. Just, it was really watching a guy flying around. Like, even in, like, the news guys in the movie in the 1930s are like, oh, man, a person's taken to the skies. But as a 13-year-old kid, I was like, oh man, a person is taken to the skies. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's that first test flight that has that's a big gopher or big gopher or whatever.
Yep.
Big gopher. Is his first test flight actually when he's using it to save that guy in the clown plane?
Yeah, they did like, because they do the test flight in the field with the statue, and that crashes, and they realize they need a helmet, so they develop a helmet. But the first time that we ever see the Rocketeer, like, go into action is the next day when they're at the clown show we were talking about, and his buddy Malcolm from the bar, who is actually Eddie Jones, the old character actor from way back when, great face, but Malcolm Eddie Jones has gone up in the clown plane and is taken over for Cliff, and things are starting to go awry. The engines are going out. He hasn't been behind the stick of a plane in so many years, and things are going south in the air show that people are paying money to watch.
Yes, it's funny that the dude who runs the air show is kind of slimy. He's like, takes over the mic, and he's like, "This is all part of the show, everybody. Stay in your seats." It's just so funny. He's the Barnum and Bailey old-timey shyster
circus
carnival guy.
Absolutely, yeah. It's all part of the show. No matter what goes wrong, the show must go on. This is all planned.
So then that's when Cliff decides, all right, give me the rocket, give me that helmet. I'm going to go save my buddy.
Yes, let's put it into action.
And of course, it seems like all of the press in Los Angeles was there to see that air show for some reason.
It was a backyard clown air show, but it was apparently the talk of the town, so why not? Yeah, no, I'm with you.
But the scene where all the reporters are running into the phones and everything, it just gave me flashbacks to all my Photoshops I do of you for Nerd Alerts.
The old school reporter. Oh, man, if I could wear a three-piece suit and have my daily beat would be what the five headlines are for the day and then find a phone booth to report into my boss, I would live in the 1930s for sure.
Sounds great. See? See?
Yeah, see?
But that's where we get him flying around all and going out of control and the big gopher part. And then my favorite part in this, I was like, that Bill Campbell, man. Why didn't I see him in a million more things? I'm glad he decided to do the stuff he decided to do. But, I mean, he could have been in this movie over and over again for me for this one scene. And the one scene is where he's sitting there. After he like skips across a pond and he's sitting there in the cat of nine tails.
Yep.
And he takes the helmet off and Peavy shows up with the truck and finds him and he's just sitting there in the mud and he's like, I like it. The way that he says, I like it.
Yeah.
It's perfect. It was like the perfect delivery of the line, the perfect look on his face. It was great.
I'm 100% with you and I'll bring this up now because this is when it started to click for me, but Billy Campbell it's kind of like the Indiana Jones or the Han Solo, that Harrison Ford just sort of rascal character where they're going to do good, but they're going to enjoy it while they do it, even if things go bonkers, you know?
Yes.
Or things go south, he's like, oh, it worked out perfectly. I didn't die. Success.
You're right. That's probably what hit me because I'm such a fan of the Han Solos, the Malcolm Reynolds,
Malcolm Reynolds.
Those type of characters. That line was very much one of those type of lines. The, I like it.
You could have almost died. Doesn't matter. I liked it.
Oh, man. And that's also, right after that is when, because he revealed himself with the rocket, apparently all the mobsters were actually at the airfield because that one guy saw the picture of Jenny in the plane, and they saw her on a date with him. All that craziness. Man, again, this is like everything is like woven together in a nice, perfect. If this doesn't happen, that doesn't happen. So this is happening.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. There's a whole bunch of little crisscrossings and subtle one-liners and sort of beat moments that connect everything. So you kind of have to pay attention, but they tie everything together perfectly.
Yeah, because that's how Neville Sinclair gets his hooks into Jenny's, because she is actually working on the set of his Robin Hood like movie.
His Errol Flynn type Hollywood picture, yes.
And she's just an extra in the background. And it's funny because apparently she did really well in reciting the speaking line, but they gave it to the producer's daughter or niece or something, whatever. And that's the funny bit to me. She's like, oh, but I, she just couldn't do, oh my gosh, stop down the set. That was great part.
Oh, wonderful. It's like, yeah, why don't you try acting by not acting? The best acting comes from not acting. But also, you're the producer's daughter, so I can't fire you. It's old school Hollywood.
Oh my gosh. It's old school Hollywood. And then Cliff knocks the freaking wall over and almost kills Neville Sinclair.
It's the perfect pratfall, because like, this movie has, as much as it has the action set pieces and things like high energy, it also has these comedic beats that this is one of the highlights where he's just standing there. He's like, I'm trying to find my girlfriend on the set. And then an entire set falls over. He's like, hi, I'm Cliff. I'm here for Jenny.
I know. Oh, my goodness.
Totally seems like a Malcolm Reynolds or a Harrison Ford.
I know. But that's where Neville finds out, because two and two is put together, because all the mobsters were at the air show, too. So they saw the rocket. And they put two and two together and realize that that girl might know where this rocket is.
I guess in 1938, there really wasn't that much going on. So if it was the air show, that's your plans for the week? Sure. Even mobsters show up? I guess that's it.
They were there searching the place for the rocket, because they found out that it was actually not the rocket that the feds had. It was a vacuum cleaner.
The old switcheroo, they figured it out. But we get to see Timothy Dalton be suave and smooth, and he tries to take away Cliff's girlfriend, Jenny, and he seduces her and sort of does the big show of, hey, I'm going to take you to this fancy club, and I'm going to treat you real nice like your boyfriend doesn't. Don't you want to be with me so I can find out all your secrets? Evil guy, charm, charm.
Evil guy, charm, charm.
And he takes her to the South Sea Club, which to me, I don't know. This may just be me because I'm biased now and have too much pop culture in my brain. But he takes her to the South Sea Club, which is, seems like Club Obi-Wan from Indiana Jones 2.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
I mean, it's got the watery set pieces, the giant shells, the fancy tables, the foliage. Oh, I love it.
Yeah, it's old Hollywood, right?
And at the South Sea Club, we get to see W.C. Fields make a cameo. I mean, they're throwing historical people in just these little tidbits that just add a little bit of authenticity and truth to this comic book narrative that's going on. What are they doing?
I know. It's interesting, too, because it's like you could have picked any. They must have just known that there's this guy that does a killer W.C. Fields, I guess.
I believe it.
Because, you know, there's tons of actors from back then you could have gone to. But it's funny that was one of those I had to explain to my kids. Like, they're like, who is this guy? What's he doing? Why are they zooming in on Jenny's uptops? What's going on here? You know,
we're keeping it a PG-13 podcast, but there are so many subtle boob jokes in this movie. It's ridiculous. The uptop, the double uptops being one of them, and we'll leave it at that. But man, if you catch them, they're an extra giggle in this. It's curious hearing it from your boy's perspective, because I guess that may be a drawback, that if you aren't familiar with this time period, you might miss a lot of these little details. But
yeah, for sure. I mean, the only reason I know who W.C. Fields is from watching Looney Tunes.
Yeah. W.C. Fields, there was another one. I mean, like, Howard Hughes is a name, but he's sort of a offshoot name, you know? Mm-hmm. Unless you're familiar with history, you won't know him, but it's cool that they incorporate all that. I'm pretty sure that comes from the graphic novel, you know, because it is written about that time. But even cooler still that they're incorporating it into a 90s Disney movie.
And also, too, while this is happening, Cliff and Peavy are, like, having to make getaways from everyone who's after this rocket.
Everybody and anybody, yeah.
And one of the scarier ones is Lothar.
Lothar, played by the actor. I have to call this out, because it's a hilarious real name for this character, but the actual actor's name is Tiny Ron?
Yep.
Tiny Ron plays Lothar, this giant hulk of a thug.
Tiny Ron Taylor. Yeah, he was an actor from back in that day where he did tons of big suit monsters, anything big. And it's funny because he had like this crazy prosthetic chin and nose, and he looked like a Dick Tracy character because he was based on an actual comic character from The Rocketeer. So they were trying to make him look like that.
That makes sense. But he is 100% a Dick Tracy character. Like this movie tends to shy away from getting like too cheesy, but I would say Lothar is probably as comic booky as it gets, because it really, like, I'm with you. It looks 100% like Dick Tracy, like Bricktop, all those guys. He He seems like he'd fit in more with that than he would with Rocketeer. But
exactly. But the, there's that scene where he comes to their house.
Yep.
And then the feds show up and they just Bonnie and Clyde that house. It's like they're in there, see? And, you know, and they come to the door and Lothar takes two shots through the door and Tommy Gunn, like you said, Tommy Gunn's all the time. It's like they were running a sale on Tommy Gunn's.
It's the old John Mulaney comedy bit where it's like, it's before the internet, it's before like photo IDs really, or like newscasts, or they were just like, hey, I'm going to use my Tommy gun to sign my name on your house, and you can tell them it was the Thompson twins kind of stuff. I think even Peavy makes a reference to it when Cliff was like, hey, we got to go back to your house. He's like, I don't have a house anymore, it's a gazebo, and that was after they had shut it up.
Yeah, that's a great line. And the funniest part is Lothar's just standing there, not getting shot.
Yep.
And then his hat gets knocked off, and he's like, oh, it's actually, I should probably leave. Like, his hat getting knocked off makes the big giant man realize that it's dangerous.
It's the old Mongo from Blazing Saddles character. It's like, oh, yeah, I guess I should go. Here's a random tidbit that I got from the trivia section of IMDb, one of my favorites, but the person responsible for Lothar's facial makeup, do you know who that is?
No.
Rick Baker.
Oh.
Classic horror movie Rick Baker.
Yes.
Did the prosthetics for this. So as much as I will slander it and say it was the cheesiest part of this movie, cool that it's actual like Hollywood legend behind it. So thumbs up for that.
That is great. So they get away from Lothar. They go back to their diner. The diner plays in this, too. Let's talk about the diner for a second.
Let's do it.
The diner where all the pilots hang out is a
Bulldog Cafe, something like
Bulldog
that?
Bulldog Cafe, yeah. There you go. And it looks like a bulldog. It's one of those fun L.A. places where they would do stuff like that over there. Famous giant donut.
Where the actual entrance is whatever the name of the restaurant is, and you get to walk through a bulldog's mouth to get into the Bulldog Cafe. But the Bulldog Cafe is where we meet all the like the B characters from the airfield and all of Cliff's sort of it's this real quick world building that this movie does, and there's so many sort of supporting cast characters that they throw in here that are all amazing. Millie runs the diner, you've seen her in a million TV shows. We were talking about Malcolm. I mean, and these are just sort of quote-unquote cast-off characters for this movie, and it's just, it's great.
Yeah, but it's his family, really, is what it is.
Yes.
So they go to hide out there, and that's where we get the funnest use of the gum, is because running away from the feds shooting up the place, they managed to get out with a rocket, but the rocket took a hit.
Yeah, it took a bullet to the back.
So the mobsters find him, and they got to get out of there, see?
We got to scram.
But he had the gum stuck on the back of the rocket, and you get that. It's like almost an iconic scene in my mind if you love The Rocketeer.
Absolutely.
When he uses the gum to plug the hole in the jetpack.
I made the joke at the start of this episode, but that gum is one of the main protagonists of this movie. Like, it makes its appearance in the first act, it saves the day in the second act, and it comes into play in the third act. So, Beeman's lucky gum is a protagonist in this movie. Mikey's hot take.
Beeman's lucky gum. Is that a real gum?
It is a real gum, and apparently, and here's the thing, historically, it was actually considered a lucky gum because it was like one of those, like, they advertised it as Beeman's chewed on by pilots, and that's what they
really
came in. Yeah,
wow.
The astronauts in the right stuff, Chuck Yeager and his crewmen's, like, they were all supporters of Beeman's gum as the lucky chewing gum. It is a thing that the Rocketeer pulled in from history, just like W.C. Fields and all these other people.
Wow, I think I need to get me some of that and stick it on the back of my car.
It covers bullet holes and it allows you to take off to escape from the feds. What more can you ask?
Oh, great. So that's going on. Well, that's kind of like simultaneously happening while we're having the fun scene at the South Seas. Is that what it's called? South Seas?
Yeah, the South Sea Club. Yep.
South Seas Club. And Cliff eventually shows up there because he realizes everyone starts putting two and two together.
Yep.
I got to tell Jenny what's going on.
She's my girl. I got to go after her, Peeve. You don't understand. I'm in love.
Oh, man. And it's great because that has one of those. I know I pick up on these tiny little scenes, but I love them. I love the little foreshadowings that happen here. And a lot of people might be like, oh, well, I saw that coming. But to me, it's like, I'm so delighted while I'm watching this movie that it's like, ooh, I saw that coming. It's like a totally different I saw that coming.
Yeah.
It's like a happy I saw that coming. And one of these tiny little scenes is where he hides the rocket in the laundry bag in the laundry room.
Yep, of the club, yep.
Yeah, and you're like, I sure hope there isn't a whole bunch of laundry added to that later.
Sure hope it doesn't get mixed up. Lo and behold, it does get mixed up.
Yes.
One of my favorite scenes is directly after that, and I think we enjoy this whole set piece together in the same route, but it's also funny that after he stashes the rocket in the laundry room, he steals a waiter's outfit, but instead of like changing clothes, he just puts the waiter's outfit over his flight suit.
Yeah.
That's totally an Indiana Jones move. It's like, oh, I guess this is okay. All
right. Yeah, it's not even the right size for him, so his flight suit's sticking out the bottom. It's great.
Oh, that's Cliff Secord, man. That's the Rocketeer. He's a good old boy, you know. He only plans so far in advance, but he's gonna make it work.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, it does. There is so much Indiana Jones vibe movie, for sure.
I keep bringing it up because that was the main thought in my brain. It was like, oh, this is like Indiana Jones, but a little bit snappier and funnier.
And of course, stuff goes south. He rocket pack destroys the South Seas room, basically, trying to goes all crazy. And good gracious, Jenny gets one of our favorite tropes is pulled out: chloroform on a handkerchief.
What does this rag smell like? Oh.
Oh.
Yep, it is chloroform. That's the old 1930s Hollywood sort of.
Yep. It's one of those things that always makes me be like, how prominent was this stuff? You just went down to CVS and you're like, oh, a bottle of chloroform, please.
I will say, I realized this is around the scene is when I realized that they wrote Jenny Blake, Jennifer Connelly's character, to be sort of a strong woman, an independent woman, because for as much as like Cliff is like, I gotta go after my girl, I love her, I gotta go save her, I'm the Rocketeer. In the meantime, Jenny Blake's taking care of herself. You know, she's kind of figuring it out as she goes along, and she's not really caving to anybody's pressure, whether it be, you know, whether it be Neville Sinclair or Cliff Secord. She's just dealing with the situation on her own. Like, it was really interesting to see in the 90s for this type of movie.
Yeah, for sure. She even, like, you know, gives Cliff ultimatums and stuff, and she has a way that she wants to be treated and everything.
Exactly. It's not your typical 1930s dame. Just,
well, heck, I mean, once Neville wakes her up creepily
with the chloroform, yep, or after the chloroform.
All that stuff in this era, after everything that's gone on in the news and the media and everything,
yep,
you're like, oh, goodness gracious. Oh, this is hitting kind of close to home over here, the way he's acting. But she plays it perfectly. She just like, oh, I can play off of this guy's lecherousness. We'll use a word from GURPS because we're nerds. And, oh, you want to see me in that little slinky thing? Well, leave the room. And, you know, and then she freaking manages to escape. Not only that does she manage to escape, she manages to find her way to his secret place.
Yes.
His little secret
radio layer or whatever.
Yes, and she's the one who finds out, spoiler alert, that Neville Sinclair is a Nazi.
Dun, dun, dun. Typical 90 movie bad guy. Who are the bad guys? It's the Nazis.
And they're bent on getting this rocket technology from Howard Hughes so that they can take over the world.
As much as I love it, it fits perfectly in this movie world. It is a little bit like on the nose, like, hey, guess what? The bad guys are Nazis. Hooray, you can hate them.
It's funny, too, that almost simultaneously, Cliff finds it out from Howard Hughes.
Yep.
Because they're bringing the rocket back to him. Because Howard Hughes burned the plans because he didn't want it to fall in enemy hands.
Yeah, he knew his technology could be used for evil, and so...
Yeah. They show him that for some reason, the Germans decided to make this awesome animation to show what they plan to do with the rockets. And it's one of those things where it's like you're sitting there going like, okay, this is a comic book. Yes. And it is kind of silly.
Yes.
And it does kind of make me go like, they wouldn't actually make something like that. But then it's so well done. And obviously they had the guys at Disney Animation Studios do it.
Yep.
And it looks so good. And it looks so of the times. That I was just like, whatever. Yes.
Oh, it
yes,
fit, they, yeah.
They
it fit,
did do that.
It fits so perfectly, too. Yeah, of course.
It just makes me, the way I rectify that in my brain, my willing suspension disbelief is that in that Nazi regime, in order to get Hitler to go for whatever your plans were, you had to make a cool video or something to show him.
A visual presentation. Be like, boss, here's what I got. And he's like, okay.
This is what we can do with the rocket facts.
Oh, that's amazing.
See, we were lucky because the Germans weren't able to win the war because the people who had actually the good plans didn't have time to get their things animated for them.
If animation was faster, it could have been a whole different story, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
I got you.
I do not think we should attack Russia right now. I don't know. This one, he has a good animation showing me it will go very well.
Yeah, let me show you my PowerPoint before you make your decision, but here we go. Okay, speaking of bad Nazi PowerPoint presentations and accents, did you notice there's one like Nazi I think he shows up in the third act a little bit after we're talking about. But speaking of Indiana Jones again, there's the Nazi with the wide tip fedora and the horn rim glasses.
Oh yeah. He's the guy. He's like the guy who burns his hand on the idol in Indiana Jones
and gets his face melted by the Ark of the Covenant. It's like the same character.
It is the exact same character.
Oh,
I know. It's funny. It's funny. Yeah, let's get to that part because that pretty much happens next.
Okay. Yeah. There is one tidbit.
Oh yeah.
How we get from that scene to the next scene is that. Yeah. Cliff jumps on a model plane and he rappels out of the airline hangar.
Uh-huh.
The model plane that he grabs onto, here's another little tidbit, is the Spruce Goose. It's a prototype. And Hughes turns and looks at it and he goes, oh, it does fly, which is an accurate historical reference. Howard Hughes tried to build the Spruce Goose and he only kind of got it to fly, but they made it fly in the Rocketeer. And that's just historical details. That's wonderful.
Again, wonderful and very Spielberg-y.
Absolutely.
Very Spielberg-y. Yeah, the Spruce Goose was like a giant plane, like the giantest plane that he was trying to do. Because he's just like, once again, Cliff being like, I know you got me, but no, you don't.
I got my girlfriend to save. I'm out of here. See ya, scram.
Uh-huh. Yep. And he's trying to he's going to exchange it. For Jenny, basically.
Yes. Now that the Nazi plot has been revealed and his girlfriend is still held captive by Neville Sinclair, we get to the third act and Cliff has to battle Nazis to get his girlfriend back.
This is where we get the nice, they teased it. There's so much foreshadowing and teasing in this thing. You know, they showed the newsreel about how, like, and this is pre-World War II, and the Germans were going all around, and this is also very Indiana Jonesy.
Yep.
It's a Zeppelin.
It's
one of the Hindenburg, and they're like, this Zeppelin's going to be in Los Angeles soon. And guess what? And of course they're at the LA Observatory, of course.
That's the only place they could get permits for shooting in 1990s Hollywood now.
I mean, have you ever been to the LA Observatory?
I have, just to stop by and be like, oh, this is the place from all the movies that I've seen.
I was going to say, I've never been there, but I know what it is.
You would drive by and immediately recognize it, be like, that place looks really, it's from all the movies I've seen.
All the movies. And it's also in Grand Theft Auto San Andreas?
Oh, yeah,
is that the one?
Yeah.
But,
but an excellent place for a third act showdown for sure.
Yeah, the Zeppelin flying over it, and then you get another Paul Sorvino's back. It's everybody comes together. Yes. Everybody's here. You got the feds. You got the mob. You got the Nazis.
You got the news guys. You got the airplane, the airfield guys. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, and everyone's got Tommy guns and and machine pistols.
And spotlights and crafty whiz banger slogans to say at each other.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. It's a great scene. This movie's 1991, but there are some some 80s movie making stuff spills over into it. And specifically, I'm thinking of the scene where you got the feds and the mobsters shooting right next to each other, and they look at each other being like, should we be shooting at each other? And they're like, nah, we're gonna shoot these krauts.
We got a common enemy now, boys. Turn fire and shoot. That's how they resolve it, and that's how those storylines come crashing in. It's wonderful.
It is great. And then another thing I have on my notes to bring up is, and this was very telling and interesting to me, and I wish they do this in movies more, when they, and you might have not known this because I know that you like to watch stuff with subtitles on.
Yes.
But when they're on the Zeppelin and Neville Sinclair is speaking German to the Germans.
Yes.
There are no subtitles. They're just speaking German.
You're supposed to figure it out. It sounds like bad guy talk. I guess that's something evil. Yep.
It's very interesting to me. And I don't know. I wasn't really able to dig up why that decision was made, but I kind of like it.
It's I think it's going, it's old school Hollywood movie again. It's like Hunt for Red October, you know. For the first part of that movie, they didn't give you the Russian subtitles. So It's sort of like, it's a little bit more mysterious and ominous if you don't, like, you get the tone of what they're saying, but you don't know the exact words. I'm with you.
Yeah, because it's not important to what's going on to know exactly what they're saying.
Yes.
So why show what they're saying? And then when you needed to understand them, they would talk in English, but they'd be addressing the people who only spoke English there.
That's
so
true.
It made sense. So it was interesting to me.
And then you got to see Timothy Dalton go from a posh British guy to, like,
yes,
uber Nazi. Like,
he was faking his accent the whole time.
He leans into that German accent at the end of this movie.
I know. But you're right. That was where, and you said it before, that was where the guy from Indiana Jones suddenly shows up out of nowhere. And he's like, hey, you better get that rocket, and then falls out. It was so quick. He showed up and left so fast.
I don't mean to get too heavy, but is that based off an actual Nazi? Is that like a Himmler or a Goebbels kind of thing? Or is that just, are they referencing Indiana Jones?
I don't know. I think they're referencing Indiana Jones. I mean, like I said, when movies like this, they don't get sequels made and they don't really have this Gigundo following.
Yep.
You don't really find much about, there haven't been tons of interviews about it.
That's true.
With Joe Johnston or anything. So, and I don't know about the circles these guys run in, but I wouldn't be surprised if Joe Johnston was like, hey, Steven, look what I put in my old Nazi movie. You know what I mean? I don't know.
I believe it. And Dave Stevens, the author that was responsible for the graphic novel, who apparently had a hand in this movie, is apparently also a history buff. So I'm sure between the two of them, they were actually like, this is all cleverly planned, like intentional. So I'm with you.
But how about that? How did you feel about the final climactic, not the Hindenburg battle?
I was disappointed that we didn't get to see much of the Rocketeer being the Rocketeer, but I guess budget ran out in the third act, so that justifies it. But we do get to see huge blimp explosions, and we get to see a little tidbit of Sinclair crashes into the Hollywood land sign.
Yeah.
And it becomes the Hollywood sign, which is historically accurate. Not for Sinclair crashing into it, but it used to be Hollywood land, and now it's Hollywood. And they threw that in. And that was part, like, all part of the culmination of all the explosions that were going on. It's definitely satisfying. I mean, it's a great action set piece for sure.
Yeah, that's where the gum came in his third act, heroism, right?
Exactly.
Because it was covering the hole that was letting the fuel spill out.
Yep.
And Cliff pulled that gum off there and is like, okay, take the rocket. See you later, buddy.
This was the culmination of the arc of why I say the chewing gum is the protagonist, because we introduce him in the first act as his lucky best friend, even though if you pay attention, PV pulls the gum off the plane when he's taking off, so that's why the plane crashes. So,
Really?
Really. You got to watch it quick.
I didn't notice that.
But there's a real quick scene where as it's taken off, PV pulls it off, so things go wrong, which means the gum is lucky. Second act, the gum is used to patch up the bullet hole so that Cliff can take off and go save Jenny. So lucky gum works there. And then lucky gum being taken off the jetpack to be the foil of the bad guy, it works as intended. The gum comes through in all acts.
It does. And there's wonderful peril through the whole thing.
Yep.
We don't have to worry about power creep because he's still just a guy. So you actually are worried every time everyone's falling and slipping and sliding around the top of a balloon. But one thing that got me super excited, and this goes back to the other guys who are in our podcast crew, this is very internal, but we had a role-playing game that was based on pilots from World War One, and an autogyro did appear prominently in that game we played. So when PV shows up with an auto gyro, I was like, auto gyro.
What's an auto gyro for people that don't know that concept though?
It's an early form of a helicopter where the top blades aren't actually powered. They're part of how it flies.
Yeah.
So it's where a helicopter was kind of first. It doesn't fly like, it flies like an airplane, but it uses those top blades as the lift. So.
But it's PV coming to save the day as the wise old mentor and the guy that said, I told you so, you should have listened to me.
Yeah, it's great. So that's pretty much it, except for like the epilogue.
Yep, get to see Howard Hughes again and some Lucky Gum, and also...
Yeah, Howard Hughes delivers him a new plane to race in the races as a thank you for saving the world.
You defeated Nazis. Here you go, kid. Here's a new plane and some chewing gum. Hope you have a good Saturday.
Yeah, right? But we also get the obvious... we hope there's a sequel with PV being like he has the plans that he copied for the jetpack, and he goes, oh, I think if I reroute the flick flackle to the thing flongle.
Meanwhile, Cliff and Jenny are all, oh, well, come let us kiss with tongues. Blah, 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 blah.
So,
but I didn't even realize that because I'm watching it now knowing there hasn't been a sequel in 30 years, but that's totally a setup. He has the plan. Uh-huh. The Rocketeer can continue. Yes. I didn't even realize that. That's great.
Yes. So anyway, we went through that whole thing, but. That's the best way to hit all the points. So overall, I guess we can do our pizza ratings and then give final thoughts during our pizza ratings. We like to do a pizza rating. We base all our movies and shows on an 8 scale. 8 slices of pizza are usually how a pizza comes cut.
Yep.
So a full 8 slices would be our best, and we can add toppings to it depending on how we want to adjust it. So it's actually way more than 8. Scales. There's in between ones too.
Yes. The ratings are arbitrary but important.
Yes. It's like, whose line is it anyway?
Yes.
Where the points don't matter.
Exactly.
So, do you want to go first? Should I go first? Who talks first, Mikey?
Poe
Dameron says.
I want to know if you had real quick speculation, what pizza rating would your boys give it, seeing it for the first time?
I did. I got pizza ratings from them.
Awesome.
And even though they are twins, the ratings are very different.
Even better.
So Gabe, he only gives it 5 slices of pizza because he said it was kind of corny.
Okay. valid. I get it.
Alex gives it 6 slices of pizza, but with heavy toppings.
Heavy toppings, so he enjoyed himself.
Yes. Okay. So I guess it would be a 6 slice supreme pizza because he wanted to give it 6.5, and I'm like, we don't do halves, we do toppings.
Nobody eats a half slice of pizza. If you pick a slice, you're going to eat the slice. You got to commit.
Yes. So it would probably be 6 supreme. So he liked it quite a bit more, but not that much. So that's not bad.
And then what does Dad say about it? What is your pizza rating on it?
Oh, this movie, I give this movie a solid 7 slices of pizza.
Ooh, nice.
I don't know if I'm putting toppings on it or not because it's an older movie, but it really, really surprised me. I went into it going like, I remember loving this movie.
Yep.
And like we said before, that can bite you sometimes. Nostalgia goggles and all that stuff.
Exactly.
But I could see the bones of Joe Johnson and doing his run through Marvel, the MCU, doing the Winter Soldier.
Mm-hmm.
Not Winter Soldier, the First Avenger, sorry.
First Avenger, yeah.
I could see so much of the influence of the 80s, Indiana Jones style movies that I love. Top to bottom, the acting was great from the most minor character to the most major character. There, I don't think there was a bad beat at all.
Yep.
It was just enjoyable. I mean, especially in these times where we're trying to distract ourselves from everything that's going on. I mean, this was just a shove popcorn in your mouth, take me away to another world type film. I really, really enjoyed it. Yep, 7 slices.
Oh, I'm right there with you. I think we're on the same page. Like, I'm with you in that I haven't seen this movie in about 10, 15 years, something like that. But this is 8 out of 8 Stromboli, double layer, calzone pizza for me because not only did I love this movie growing up being like, oh, a dude has a helmet and he can fly and he looks so cool. Like, that was enough to get me on board. Having watched this movie for our podcast, yes, I watched it, to take notes, but then I ended up watching it again the next day just on my own because I enjoyed it so much. It is the perfect Saturday afternoon, just like you're saying, put popcorn in your mouth. It moves at a quick pace, and There's no real fluff. There's no real dragging points. There's a whole bunch of little details to pick up on if you're paying attention. If not, you're just watching a cool guy go save his girlfriend and beat up Nazis. I mean, that's old pulp serial Hollywood magic epitomized to me. So I'm with you. I can't really find a fault. Like, there are some cheesy points in this movie, but none of them are so cheesy that it ever really takes me out of it. Like, it all fits into this world. So this movie is going in on my list of, I don't know, top 20, top 50.
Oh, wow.
Favorite movies of all time, just because what's wrong with it? It's a good time. How can you, if you have complaints about The Rocketeer, I want to hear them and yell at you for being wrong. So
once this is all over, you're going to have to come over and yell at my kid.
Okay, I will. I'll set them straight and be like, Howard Hughes is this crazy guy who's awesome and WC Fields.
Yeah, I think probably a lot of their perspective comes from them growing up in the MCU era and that stuff being a little more grittier.
I get it.
And a little more quote-unquote real, I guess.
Yeah, this is very lighthearted and wholesome intentionally rather than being true to life or gritty like a Batman or something. I get it.
It's also like comic books were back then.
Yeah.
Comic books were a lot lighter.
Yep.
And were less serious in 91. So being people who lived during that era, I think it feels a little more comfy to us. But that being said, I bet you as they get older, I bet you if they watch this as later teenagers or even like young adults, I bet you their rating might change. Because
if they learn some history, they might appreciate it a little bit more. Yeah, get some context to it. Yeah.
But definitely great. The one thing that makes me sad about it, if you're saying why are you taking a pizza thing off, is that it doesn't have more. I'm taking the slice away from you, Joe Johnston, for not fighting hard enough to make more of these things or whatever studio, Disney. Why?
Yeah.
Why is there not more of it? And also, too, I don't want to, you know, there's nothing you can do now. All the actors are too old. But, I mean, if you want to find the right people, maybe we can do a fun study. Maybe we can put it on our socials or maybe we can talk about it on another podcast. But it might be fun to cast a reboot of this movie.
Who would be in Rocketeer 2020?
Yeah, and say, don't change do the first one exactly the same, or just jump to the second episode and leave the first one. Say, yep, that happened.
Yeah.
If you want to see what happened earlier, these characters, watch the first one. We don't have to redo the origin story like they do all the time, which would be interesting because they've never done that before. It would be interesting to do that and being like, I don't think the studios are brave enough to do it, but I think if you're brave enough to say, yes, this movie, I know it's all different actors and stuff, but if you watch Solo now, Solo's all different actors too.
True.
And that was it. So let that be like that happened to these characters, but these characters are now being played by these people in Rocketeer 2 or whatever.
I'm on board with that 100%. Yeah.
So get Joe Johnston back and do Rocketeer 2 with new actors.
Instead of Hitler, he can be fighting the Cold War or something. Like, give him the historical backdrop whenever you want, but just bring the Rocketeer back. I'm with you.
So, or do a Ghostbusters thing and bring back those actors and make them passing it on.
Oh, there you go.
You know?
I like it. The son of Rocketeer.
Even the daughter of Rocketeer.
Who's gonna be Billy Campbell's daughter or son? Oh, you got me brainstorming already. I like it.
Fun stuff. So, hey, everybody, if you want to jump on that fun brainstorming stuff, you can hit us up on all our social medias. We are at Assuming Pod on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. So you can check us out there, but we are going to check out a pizza because our pizza is here. Well, my pizza is here. Is your pizza there?
My pizza is here too. We can chow down together.
Awesome. We'll turn off the mics and keep this going while we each eat pizza and watch each other via video chat. But we have people to thank before we can enjoy our pizzas. We want to thank That Guy Brad for doing our announcing, Not Scott Productions for our equipment, Jazzar for doing our music, and most of all, we want to thank you guys for continuing to listen to our plucky little podcast. Thanks so much, everyone. Stay safe out there. Keep washing your hands. Follow the guidelines. And
don't forget your lucky Beeman's chewing gum.
Yeah.
Brought to you by
get your Beeman's chewing gum. Chew it up. I'm going to stick it all over the place. People are going to be like, why is there gum everywhere?
Because it's lucky and it's going to save my life when I have to fight Nazis. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks. just binge-watched all the Clone Wars up till the one before. I guess it's the penultimate one, I think.
I haven't been keeping up with it. I saw it online. Are they at the last one or no?
May the 4th, I think the last one comes out, I think.
Ah, okay, that makes sense. But they're close to the end. That's cool that you guys are keeping up. Your boys are liking it?
Yeah, they like it a lot. They watched the whole thing. Like one summer, I think they were just going through it. So they're more up on it than I am. I had a hard time keeping up with all that stuff, but it's kind of their bag.
I got you. That's cool, though. But they're sort of setting up the Clone Wars to tell Ahsoka's story so she can appear in Mandalorian.
Yeah. Okay. It's very focused on her, pretty much.
Okay.
And, like, the last episode we watched, Order 66 just happened.
Ah, execute Order 66. That's great.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting.
Right on.
And Maul in there. They're kind of arranging Maul stuff with everything. So,
but that's in the timeline, that's with Darth Maul where he has, like, the robotic legs, like Rogue One kind of thing, or no?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I haven't been keeping up with it, so I don't know.
I can talk about it without being too spoilery because everything that's happening and that was interesting to me is stuff that everybody pretty much knows. They're just playing it out now.
They're filling in the gaps of the, like, sort of the rumored details, right?
Right. So, yeah, they're just filling in the gaps. So,
I got you.
There's things that I can say that won't spoil stuff that's interesting to me. Yeah, whatever.
Whatever, so. Indeed. Yeah. Now I'm with you.